From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Millennial state lawmakers, both Democrat and Republican, form a caucus to build alliances across the aisle.
We're going to be a vehicle that brings people together, and hopefully the relationships that are built within this caucus lead to solutions down the road.
Plus, U.S. carmakers take a wait-and-see stance toward recent signs China may give a little in rules protecting its growing auto industry.
You know, in dropping tariffs on foreign imported cars, is kind of like Xi Jinping giving Trump the sleeves of his vest.
What it takes to be a true ally to Native people, a willingness to see things with new eyes.
Take the National Parks Movement. Yeah, that was supposed to be about protecting the environment for all, yet many indigenous people were displaced off of their lands to make way for those national parks.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, environmentalists care very much about our land, air, and water. But when it comes to working with indigenous people, often there's a blind spot.
Take the National Parks Movement. Yeah, that was supposed to be about protecting the environment for all, yet many indigenous people were displaced off of their lands to make way for those national parks.
And then we'll hear about the Michigan origins of just why the United States grows so many soybeans. But first, it's time to put people over party. That's the idea driving young legislators across the country to group together in a bipartisan way. They're forming caucuses as part of the Millennial Action Project's State Future Caucus Network. Lawmakers under age 40 who want to govern in a different way. With us now are the co-chairs of the My Future Caucus, State Representative Abdullah Hamoud, who's a Democrat from Dearborn, and Representative Jim Lilly, Republican from Park Township. Both of you, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So good to have you with us. I'm going to start with you, Representative Jim Lilly, and ask you, how is the way the legislature has been working failing millennials? I mean, what are the problems that you're seeing with the business as usual in the legislature?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So, you know, I think there's a lot of things that are working well, but one of the things that I would say is that in all the town halls that I do and all the forums that I meet with in district, I never hear anybody clamoring for less bipartisanship. And I think that that's really what this caucus is about. It's about putting together a group of people that are willing to sit down, have discussion, build some relationships. And at the end of the day, in a term-limited environment, which is what we're in, I think it's that relationship piece that's really missing, which is really sort of creates a challenge in building those alliances across the aisle.
Indeed, that's something you hear from past legislators when term limits were not there, that you had the time to build that sense of kind of camaraderie, mutual respect, and as you say, relationships. And I'm wondering, Representative Hamoud, take us more deeply into the goal of the My Future Caucus. How do you hope it would unite legislators?
Yeah, first and foremost, the My Future Caucus, the entire premise is about providing the opportunity for younger legislators to get to know one another on a more personal level. For us to actually have the opportunity to debate one another, maybe on certain issues that are surfacing, for us to visit one another's districts, to understand what the problems that are being faced in those districts outside of our own. And I think providing us with that perspective then allows us to come back together and maybe work on some issues that matter to all of us. You know, the whole idea behind the Future Caucus isn't that we're going to be this machine that pushes forth legislation. Rather, we're going to be a vehicle that brings people together, and hopefully the relationships that are built within this caucus lead to solutions down the road.
How many other state legislators have joined you in the caucus now?
You know, I think from a numbers perspective, I think we're somewhere in the mid-20s. Admittedly, it's a little bit fluid, but that's sort of where we're at right now from a numbers perspective.
And the idea is that these are legislators under the age of 40, so millennial lawmakers, and wanting to represent millennial issues?
So we say if you're the young or young at heart, so we're not going to exclude anyone. I think everyone represents millennials within their district. And so, you know, the premise behind the caucus is to try to keep the younger people here in Michigan. And so, you know, if that is something that you're passionate about, we welcome you to the table.
I'm curious, why did each of you decide to run for the legislature, and how were things different once you got there from what you expected? Why don't you start, Representative Lilly?
Yeah, so from my perspective, I think there's a lot of reasons that I ran for the legislature, but ultimately I think you can't really complain about something if you're not willing to step up and do something about it. So public service has always been a big part of what I believe in, and I've always spent a lot of time volunteering for nonprofits and serving on boards. But I view this as an opportunity to get involved at a little bit of a different level and really bring to the table some experience that I had both as a younger person. I'm technically not a millennial, but just over the cusp, but really as a business person too. And I think it's that perspective, those unique perspectives, that when we come together, when we build relationships and we share those perspectives, that's when we can be really effective as legislators.
And how were things different from what, once you were in there in Lansing and working day to day, how was it different than from what you thought it would be?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And again, I'd go back to that comment that I made earlier about relationships and term limits. I think that that's something that's missing here. I think it's very hard for people to build those relationships and be effective. From an organizational perspective, if we take things back to the way businesses function, they're very hierarchical in nature. There's delineated lines of decision making. And in the legislature, there's just a lot more perspectives that get sort of merged together, and everybody comes in with sort of the same, vote. And so we really got to get to a point where we trust one another, and that's hard to do without having those relationships. I think both in our own caucuses and across the aisle, taking that time and developing those relationships is something that we need to spend more time doing. But in the era of term limits, it's very difficult to do.
So what about you, Representative Hamoud? Why did you run?
Simply put, I wanted to be an advocate for the community that provided my family and I with everything. My parents, who immigrated to the city of Dearborn, myself, who was born and raised in the city of Dearborn, educated in the city of Dearborn, just trying to provide, using this platform to give back to those residents. I gave my family everything.
How do you think that we got to where we are today with Congress and with state legislatures, this sense that party matters more than anything and the resulting gridlock? And how do you think this has hurt Michigan, Representative Lilly?
Yeah, so what I would say about that is, unfortunately, and this is a statistic that came forward as we were putting the Millennial Action Project together here in Michigan, but the vast majority of millennials sort of look at public service and they don't view it as an honorable position. And I think that's created a little bit of a toxic environment here. It's puts a lot of pressure on us as legislators to perform, which I think is appropriate. But at the same time, I think there's this perception that exists that people assume that we don't get along and that we can't get along. And that's just not right. I was at dinner the other day with one of my Democratic colleagues and a business owner, and the comment was made, wow, you guys seem to generally like one another. I can't believe that that's actually the case, that exists. And it's not always that way, but I think if we want to be effective, I think we need to have some more of those interactions, and I think we need to change the perception about what public service is really about. And I think if we can do that with some of these discussions that we have within this caucus and by taking this caucus on the road and having discussions with other young millennials, I think we can maybe change what the perception is and maybe encourage more people to get involved, which I think could take some of the toxicity out of this environment.
And if I may add to that, I mean, amongst millennials now, over 70% actually don't identify with the party. Hmm. And I think that's kind of the trend that we're seeing our political system move towards. One of the difficulties is when we assumed office, and I know this is probably the case for Representative Lilly as well, we're realized for the single letter before my name, D or R. And you realize, you introduce yourself as Abdullah Hamoud, Democrat from District 15. And nobody pays attention to the story of this individual that's now in office or the story of the residents that are back at the district and what issues they're facing and what solutions they need. And that hyper-partisanship just gets elevated. And we're using this as an opportunity to take a step back and say, at the end of the day, we're people and we're here to represent people. And first and foremost, we need to put people first. If we have the opportunity to do that and the willingness to do that, I really think that we can reach compromise, which is oftentimes a dirty word, but can actually be a very beautiful thing.
And that idea of a dirty word, or the idea that, the party, we've got to, live and die by the party. Are you getting any pushback from, dare I say, older legislators or other legislators who don't think this is the way to go?
I think we've actually united the older legislators because they're kind of jealous. You know, some of the old legislators in both the Democratic side and Republican side actually wanted to protest outside of our caucus kickoff, jokingly. And it's because they felt excluded. I think they're just seeing these younger legislators try to come together. And I think it's just having a positive effect across the board.
And I'd just like to point out, and again, I think Representative Amud and I both agree. I mean, this isn't a silver bullet to solve a lot of the problems that we have here in Michigan, but I think it's at least a start. And on a lot of these issues, most of the stuff we deal with in here in Lansing is not necessarily partisan. And so if we can put together an institution that builds relationships and helps us deal with some of these decisions that we make on the margin, I think that can be very healthy.
How do you know when you have succeeded? How will you know when you've succeeded?
That's honestly, I think that is a question which we don't have an answer to. I mean, Representative Lilly and myself really built a strong relationship over the last year, just getting to know one another, you know, speaking to, you know, kind of our backgrounds. We have similar backgrounds in some ways. But, you know, like personally, I'm working now with several of my Republican colleagues that are from the caucus based on relationships that I've built trying to form this caucus alongside Representative Lilly. And we actually have a legislation that we've introduced together, and I take that as a win. Not to say that the legislation has moved anywhere or that it's adopted by the caucus in general, but I have a relationship with individuals who I otherwise would not have, and we've actually worked together to construct a solution for a problem that both our residents face in different parts of the state.
It's worth pointing out that from a membership perspective, our caucus here contains some of what the, you know, sort of pundits here in Lansing would consider the most conservative and most liberal legislators. And the fact that these folks are willing to come together and even have a discussion in and of itself is really progress.
Yeah.
The co-chairs of the My Future Caucus, State Representative Abdullah Hamoud, Democrat from Dearborn, and Representative Jim Lilly, Republican from Park Township. Thank you so much for sharing this work with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much
for
having us.
Thank you.
Remember that meteorite, the one that exploded over southeast Michigan back in January? Well, a golf ball-sized chunk went up for sale at the famed Christie's Auction House this month. Bidding began at $12,000 and closed yesterday without a single offer. But that has not dampened the experience for the fragment's owner, Royal Oak resident Ashley Moritz.
It's been, you know, a really fun experience, and that's been the best part of the whole thing, in my opinion, was the fun of going out with my boyfriend and looking for it and finding it, and then all the press and the auction, and then the auction didn't go, and then all the rest of the phone calls. And it's just been such an experience that's a lot of fun.
Ashley says she has gotten some new offers in the past 48 hours, but she's not in a rush to find a buyer. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Protecting the Great Lakes and Michigan's natural resources, it's a crucial task that's best accomplished by Michiganders working together. And that means all Michiganders, including the First Peoples. So how can non-Indigenous people be good allies to Indigenous people in the quest for environmental justice? Kyle Powys-White is a Potawatomi environmental justice advocate, and he's an associate professor of philosophy and community sustainability at Michigan State University. Kyle, welcome to Stateside. It's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. It's good to have the chance to talk to you.
You say that you're often asked that very question, how can non-Indigenous people be good allies to Indigenous people, that other environmentalists ask you this question, and that the answer lies in understanding settler privilege. What is that?
That's a very important question. And what I think we need to understand with the idea of settler privilege is that we live in a society where the benefits, the economies, the overall ways of life are only possible from having dispossessed many Indigenous people of their lands and of their waters. And for people who benefit from that, who are not Indigenous, settler privilege is the idea that they oftentimes don't have to confront that reality in their daily lives.
And so how does that color our thinking?
Well, for example, oftentimes at the level of speech, you'll hear people say, oh, well, the United States gives indigenous people, you know, land or gives them, you know, economic benefits or opportunities. And that can be extremely offensive to a lot of native people because the U.S. hasn't actually given us anything, you know, right?
Au contraire.
And, right, exactly.
It and took so, away.
No, that's exactly right. And so oftentimes that language can be microaggressive. But then on the broader scale, much of the land in states like Michigan, you know, is stolen land. And the indigenous people, the tribes in Michigan are seeking to restore their sovereignty, their self-determination in those lands. Yet if you look at a lot of policies in Michigan, they don't really address that key issue for Native people.
So, Kyle, how do you answer people when they are talking with you and they ask you the question, how much of what happened and decisions that were made decades ago or centuries ago, how much of that lies on my shoulders in 2018? When someone who is non-Indigenous says that, what's your answer?
A lot still rests, I think, on people's shoulders because many of the same practices that occurred historically are still things that are enacted today. And so I think that for people living right now, they have a great responsibility to address their actual current complicity. So for example, a lot of environmentalists are very adamant that in Michigan, we need to do what we can to protect, you know, wilderness areas or to protect shorelines. But oftentimes when people say that, they're just thinking of those areas as places for recreation, whereas historically, there really was no wilderness or just, you know, open shoreline. Those were all areas that were part of indigenous economies, indigenous self-determination, culture, religious and spiritual practices. And so for a lot of Native people, I think that's what we want back. and we can't get that back if somebody else primarily sees those areas as recreation and leisure areas.
That's a good for instance. Well, for those of us with settler privilege, to learn how to be good allies to Native peoples. I understand there are certain approaches to be avoided, beginning with something called the romantic approach. Just what is that, Kyle?
So the romantic approach is this idea that I think a lot of the listeners will be familiar with. It's this idea that Native people have the best wisdom for protecting the environment and that Native people have this special spiritual connection to the land, and that Native people never did anything that was harmful to the environment. And this is a view that stereotypes Native people, and it oftentimes just isolates a certain aspect of who we are. It just isolates the fact that we're sort of these people with this tremendous wisdom, and that it's a tragedy that our wisdom is not the prevailing way of life in the land. And so it ignores the political realities and struggles that we face as Native people. And it also doesn't allow us the opportunity to speak to our mistakes, right? It doesn't allow us the opportunity to be self-critical.
And what about this same boat approach? What is that and why should that approach be avoided?
The same boat approach is something I oftentimes here when I focus on the fact that, you know, for Native people, we really do want different things out of environmental work. We want to address racism. We want to address issues pertaining to sexism. We want to address, you know, numerous other issues that pertain to our experiences. And a lot of people say, oh, don't focus on, you know, racism, you know, don't focus on those issues. We need to just focus on, you know, big picture items like, you know, climate change mitigation that are common to everybody. And I really push back against that approach because if you look at the history of the environmental movement, it's always been about trying to suggest that environmental problems are one and the same for all, but it's indigenous people that oftentimes don't benefit from environmental reforms as much as other people. I mean, take the national parks movement. Yeah, that was supposed to be about protecting the environment for all, yet many indigenous people were displaced off of their lands to make way for those national parks.
So if you're talking about environmental activism, what I think I hear you saying is non-Indigenous people want to maintain or protect where Indigenous activists are working to restore?
I think that's one way to put it, but I'd also add that for Indigenous people too, we also have our own interventions and innovations that we're trying to do as well. So on the one hand, I think for a lot of Native people, we're trying to restore those practices and ways of life that come from our past and which can be particularly important for the future. But we're also tremendously adaptive people. You know, a lot of tribes I work with, including a lot of tribes in Michigan, they have hired their own scientists, many of whom are Native people, to do work on water quality, to do work on forestry. And I think the way that tribes do science is oftentimes different, where tribes really want to emphasize that if you're a scientist working for the tribe, you need to be accountable to the community. And so we're trying to restore, but we're also trying to innovate as well.
So we've talked about what not to do to avoid this romantic approach or this same boat approach. So let's turn to what we can and should do and the goal. And you write about decolonizing allyship. What is that and what does that look like?
That's a great question. So decolonizing allyship first means that we really need to look at, you know, what are the relationships that have really been damaged through the experience of U.S. and Canadian colonialism. And so in my work, I really highlight relationships like trust, consent, accountability, reciprocity, and many others. These are the relationships that are lacking. And so we first need to be able to engage in allyship in a way that tries to actually repair those relationships. So, for example, one thing that oftentimes happens is that an ally wants to really include Native people in a particular, you know, conservation project or pollution abatement project or climate change mitigation project, but they only invite the Native people to participate when the project is already underway. And, you know, if I want you to be part of something and I only ask you to be part of it once I've already started, you know, rolling out the project, you're not going to feel that that's a very trustworthy or consensual approach. And so Native people want to work with allies at the point of conception. And I think that's an important thing and an important lesson to learn, among many others.
Yes, and about that, what more can non-Indigenous peoples do to be true allies, to be respectful?
When we realize that our goals are to build those relationships back, it suggests that for allies, there's much more that they don't know about Native people than what they do know. And so the point of the discussion really should be, you know, how is it that Native desires for the future might be different from settler desires? And given that difference, not only how can we find points of overlap, but how can we appreciate those differences and those tensions and be open to them? And so in a lot of my work, I really talk about the fact that allies need to understand that for Native people, actually, we are kind of in a dystopian time already for our people and our cultures. And that suggests for us maybe a different approach about what we're saving, because we're not trying to avoid an environmental dystopia. We've already been through that. And so I think that's an important point of discussion for allies, to be open to that reality. But also allies need to realize that it's true that I think Indigenous people should be respected for our intellectual traditions and our wisdom, but we also need to be respected for just being people who make mistakes, people who have adapted, and people who also can use things like Western science to our advantage.
And are you seeing this kind of true allyship? Have you got examples? Have you seen where it's working?
Well, one of the things I encounter is I'll meet a lot of, especially non-Native white people who have really applied a lot of powerful allyship practices and principles. You know, even people working for state government and federal government or nonprofit or universities. But what I find is that in the institutions that they work in, they're not incentivized to do that. So, for example, a lot of state and federal agencies have tribal liaison positions, but those positions are only a small percentage of the job of whoever holds it, and oftentimes they're only in that position for a short time, and it's not really valued as a career opportunity. And so I really hope that universities and agencies and others think, wait a minute, if we do have people that want to be good allies, they should be rewarded for that.
It should be more than window dressing.
Absolutely.
What do you see as the rewards of this decolonizing allyship, where non-Indigenous and Indigenous people really are allies in the best sense of the word?
The way I look at it, and in my work with scientists, I really try to emphasize this to them, is that for many Indigenous people, whether it's the 12 federally recognized tribes in Michigan or the over 560 federally recognized tribes in the United States, many other unrecognized tribes and state-recognized tribes and Native communities, we're undertaking one of the most critical projects in the world and in history, is that we're trying to rebuild our cultures, our self-determination in the wake of some of the worst human-inflicted violence ever. And I think that that is a tremendously powerful thing to do in one's life, to actually be part of that unfolding story. And that's what I think should motivate allies.
Kyle Powys-White is a Potawatomi environmental activist who is the Timnick Chair in the Humanities, as well as an Associate Professor of Philosophy and Community Sustainability at Michigan State University. Kyle, thank you so much for sharing your work and your views with us.
Great. Good to connect with you and the listeners.
News from Beijing this week that China's President Xi is open to reducing the 25% tariffs on foreign-made cars, trucks, and SUVs, and open to full foreign ownership of auto companies in China. Sounds like a big deal, but is it? Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us now. Daniel, you described this in today's column as the art of the deal meets the Chinese way. Certainly, President Trump is taking bows for this, saying it's all due to his tough trade stance against China. Is this worth a lot of high-fiving from Team Trump?
Let me ask you this. Do you think they would be doing this out of the goodness of their hearts?
Hmm.
I don't think so. I think, look, there's a couple of things going on here. One is the Chinese auto industry is maturing very, very quickly. They've learned a lot from their foreign partners. Just this year at the Detroit Auto Show, you had a Chinese manufacturer announce that they're going to be bringing a 7-seat SUV to the U.S. market by the end of this year.
Yeah.
And then saying, basically, if we get over 100,000 units of sales, we're going to build a plant in the United States. I mean, I think they understand how the game is played. You know, and dropping tariffs on foreign imported cars is kind of like Xi Jinping giving Trump the sleeves of his vest. It's really kind of a nothing. General Motors made 4 million cars in China last year. Do you know how many cars they imported from the United States?
How many?
200 Chevy Camaros.
Wow.
200.
Okay.
It really is something that is kind of a distinction without a difference, insofar particularly as the Americans are concerned. Germans are a little different. They are importing more vehicles into China from plants outside the country. But the Americans, led by General Motors, are doing almost all of their production in the country, and I don't think they expect that to change. They have successful partnerships, and I think they want to continue those partnerships as they exist.
So what about this open to full foreign ownership of auto companies in China? I think of your phrase in your column, these are not passive players content to forever play second banana to the big boys and girls from Germany, Japan, and the United States. So who's zooming who here?
That's a great question. I mean, is a General Motors more likely to acquire the 50% ownership in their joint venture with SAIC? Possible. Or is SAIC, would they be looking to acquire, I don't know, General Motors?
Mm.
I mean, look, the Chinese have got a lot of money. They're very aggressive. They're very different than the Japanese. When the Japanese came into the United States, to a very patient, build the brand, expand, get a little pressure about trade, start to build plants in the United States. Now they are major players in the U.S. manufacturing of automobiles.
Case in point, Honda, Toyota, I'm thinking of the plants. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Chinese are different. The Chinese are acquiring their way into the big leagues. In 2010, Geely bought Volvo from Ford Motor Company. Ford owned it for, I don't know, a decade or so. Mm-hmm. I have to go back and look at it, but about a decade. And under Chinese ownership, Volvo has really blossomed. The same major shareholder in Geely has just taken a 9.7% stake in Daimler, the parent of Mercedes-Benz, shocking the Germans. So now one of the premier German companies, not just automakers, but companies in what's called Deutschland AG, its largest shareholder is a Chinese auto company. They are aggressive, on the move, and they're very willing to buy their way into the big leagues as opposed to, say, the Japanese or the South Koreans, who have taken a much more methodical, patient approach.
And U.S. carmakers have been on radio silence about these announcements. What does that tell us?
I think it tells you a couple things. One is they will do anything they can not to get crossways with the administration. There's a lot of important policy things that affect them before the administration, fuel economy being one of them. Obviously, some of the other trade issues like NAFTA, they don't really want to get crossways with them. Two, they don't want to offend their Chinese partners. These are partnerships that they've spent a lot of time and money building. And for a company like General Motors, which is second only to Volkswagen among foreign players in China, China is a very, very important market. You could make the argument that the two most or only important markets for General Motors are the United States and China. They've gotten out of Europe, as your listeners know.
Yes.
And so this is, it's kind of a binary play for them. So anything that rocks the boat over there is not beneficial to General Motors. And I think what you're going to see, they're going to sit back and watch and see how this thing develops, because they know that there's a real high stakes game of, as I said, trans-Pacific belly bumping going on here between President Xi and President Trump.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Coming up, just how did soybeans native to Asia wind up being grown in the U.S.?
Ford was famous for saying, if we want the farmer to be our customer, we must find a way to be his customer.
Henry Ford and the soybean after the break. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As President Trump and Chinese leaders swap threats of trade tariffs, we hear a lot of talk about what a 25% Chinese tariff could mean to soybean farmers in this country, certainly here in Michigan, which is one of the top soybean-producing states. But how did a legume native to East Asia wind up being such a big part of American agriculture? The answer? Henry Ford.
With one foot on the land and one in industry, America is safe, says Henry Ford. At his exposition, an industrialized barn shows how soybeans grown on the farm may be processed for industrial purposes. An extensive display of early traction engines stands in front of the Ford barn. The barn contains machinery which converts soybeans into the parts used in Ford cars. Mr. Ford has long predicted a closer and mutually profitable union between farm and industry.
Here to tell this story is Ted Genoese. His book is This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. He's editor-at-large at the Pacific Standard, a contributing editor at the New Republic, and a contributing writer at Mother Jones. And Ted Genoese, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your book tracks the rise of the soybean in this country and fixes the spotlight on Henry Ford. What got this auto pioneer thinking of soybeans in the first place?
Well, it started with a period not unlike the one that we're passing through now. There was a glut of grain that was endangering the family farm because there simply wasn't enough demand. As one of the sort of important people in pushing this movement, Wheeler McMillon said, you know, there's only so much that the human stomach can consume. And so his big push, and it really caught the ear of Henry Ford, was toward trying to find industrial uses for agricultural products, and in particular, looking at ways of extracting industrial products that would replace petroleum-based products at a time when Ford in particular was already starting to worry about petroleum reserves.
And it's worth noting, it's easy to forget in 2018, but I remember it because I used to drive by and live by the Ford tractor operations. There was a real reason Ford was interested in keeping farmers viable, because they were the ones buying Ford tractors and trucks.
Absolutely. Ford was famous for saying, if we want the farmer to be our customer, we must find a way to be his customer. And so the whole idea was, if we want to keep farmers afloat and buying tractors and farm trucks, we've got to find a way to consume and use the products that are being grown on the farm. And so that encouraged him to set up an agricultural lab at the headquarters in Dearborn to start testing all sorts of different products, looking for ways of taking the contents of these plants that he was testing and seeing if they could be converted to plastics and if the sugars could be converted to ethanol as a replacement for petroleum.
And what was it about the soybean that kind of yielded an aha moment?
Well, the great thing about soybeans is that they do two things. There's a high level of usable oils, much higher than what they had expected even when they started testing. But then also the byproduct, the soy meal that comes out after the extraction of the oils, is still very high in proteins. And what that means is that the oils were available to be used for industrial lubricants and other sorts of products that use the oil. But then those that rely on protein, including plastics, that meal could be converted in that way. And so when you think about an automobile that has all sorts of plastic parts on it and obviously has parts that are needing industrial lubricants, it was really a perfect agricultural product.
And Mr. Ford embraced the soybean with great enthusiasm, as you point out, that he eventually became the largest single soybean grower in the entire country.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, something that we don't necessarily think of these days. When we think of Ford, we don't associate that with soybean growing, but it's true. And most importantly, Ford was the one who not only planted thousands of acres, but hundreds of varieties to see which would fare best and which would yield the best. And so all of that early stock of soybeans, you know, there's been obviously lots of hybridizing and genetic modification since then. But that initial American stock of soybeans really come off of Henry Ford's farms in Michigan.
Tell us what he did to encourage Michigan farmers to grow soybeans.
The really important things that he did, first, he made all of his Fords and tractors available for free to Michigan farmers so that they didn't have to buy tractors. This is in the midst of the Depression, at a time when it's difficult for farmers to afford the overhead of buying equipment themselves. So having a tractor that they could use themselves for free was really vital. But he also offered gas and diesel essentially at cost and added about a quarter of what it would have cost commercially. So for farmers who were concerned or were suspicious of trying to move to a different crop, this really took all of the risk out of it and allowed them to plant those acres. And then most importantly, Ford said, whatever you grow, I'll buy the whole yield. So you don't have to worry about trying to find a market for it. I will not only reduce your overhead, I will guarantee you a sale.
Boy, it's not hard to see why a lot of Michigan farmers decided soybeans looked a lot more attractive than corn.
Absolutely, yes. And all sorts of other crops, too, that at the time were much more common. And this really allowed the soybean to surge at a time when it was really necessary to have a profitable yield just to stay afloat.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with writer Ted Genoways as we track the role of Henry Ford in making America such a big soybean producer. And Ted, you write that once Saudi Arabia's petrochemical resources were uncovered in 1938, industrial uses for soy were no longer worth exploring because of low oil prices. But by then, farmers had discovered a steady diet of soybeans could fatten up their animals. So what happened to the soybean industry then?
Well, that's really when what we think of as sort of the traditional agricultural powers moved in. Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill both saw this opportunity because there was no longer the demand created by the auto industry. It brought the prices of soybeans down, and that meant that it was more affordable for them as a feed source. And so they moved in, started building processing plants and elevators, and they also encouraged the Farm Bureau to get involved in helping to train farmers in ways of achieving higher yields. And it really, at that point in the late 30s, moved from being something that was an industrial product to being something that was a feed source for livestock, and in particular at that point for cattle.
If we think about as a matter of survival, farmers are very knowledgeable on global trade and foreign policy, just as much as they are about the daily weather. But, you know, what about at an emotional level? I mean, you spent a year with a soybean farming family in Nebraska. So how do these farmers feel about their place in the global economy and their dependency on U.S. foreign relations?
I think right at the moment, they feel in a very precarious spot. I mean, there have been a number of hard years in a row where many family farms are just barely breaking even and holding on by taking out loans. And so the prospect of having a trade war that greatly reduces demand for soybeans from China, also the rumblings about NAFTA and what that might do in terms of demand for corn from Mexico, for many of these farmers that are growing on corn-soybean rotations, it means that there's the sort of looming threat of losing as much as a third of their income. And I don't think we have to do too much imagining to picture what sort of stress that would put on any family. You know, if we suddenly lost a third of what we had expected to be coming in, it puts everything at risk. But I think it's especially potent for these families and emotional for them because it's not just a home, it's not just a job. It's very often a piece of ground and a livelihood that they've been connected to for many generations. And so they don't feel that they're just failing in their own endeavors, but really letting down the generations that came before.
Boy, that just hurts to hear you describe that situation. We've had so many farmers in the last few days just saying this all could not have come at a worse time for us.
It really couldn't. And this is exactly the moment that farmers are having to decide what they're going to plant and how much they're going to plant. And to have this incredible uncertainty at a time when they're struggling already, it's put a great deal of stress on farmers. And I can say here in Nebraska, talking to people at the farmers union here, they said, you know, that the calls to the suicide hotline are heavier than they've been in many, many years, that farms are being lost here in the state at a rate faster than they have been in many years. So it's a really stressful time already, and to have this level of uncertainty introduced into it is just the worst of all possible worlds.
Henry Ford always warned against the federal government intervening, attempting to control commodities like soybeans, dare we say weaponizing food. Is what we're seeing right now between the U.S. and China and other nations, is this the realization of what he was talking about?
In many ways it is, because, you know, his notion was that even when the government is meaning to step in and support the farms, it was often causing sort of secondary problems that couldn't be foreseen. For Ford, what he was concerned about was the kind of price controls that were being instituted, especially as the United States got into World War II. But now we're seeing a situation where farmers have been encouraged to grow certain crops and in certain ways because of tax incentives and because of insurance incentives. Very often, insurance is given out according to what the highest use of the land would be. The taxes are assessed according to what the highest use would be. And what that means is the highest paying and highest yielding crops. But of course, those crops very often that are most cost effective and profitable are supported by the government. So it's creating an artificial situation. And occasionally when we have these sorts of moments where the government goes from supporting an industry to trying to use that industry, as you said, as a tool or even a weapon of foreign policy, it causes great, great problems for the industry itself. We've all heard Donald Trump say that the farmers are great patriots and willing to make these sacrifices. And I think that generally that's true. But I hope that the president also recognizes, while this may be sort of a momentary trade war and a kind of momentary correction in trade policy that the White House is trying to effect, it's often 100 or 150 years of history for these families. It's really not enough to say we'll make it up to them later, because if a family loses a farm that has been with their family for 150 years, there just isn't any way to make that up to them later.
Ted Genoways is author of the book, This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. Ted, thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
This truly has been the winter of our discontent, even if spring officially arrived a month ago. And as challenging as the snow, ice, and flood advisories have been across the Lower Peninsula in recent days, the UP has really been challenged, hammered by snow. Here's an example. More than 2 feet of snow fell in Menominee over this past weekend, and some drifts were 10 feet high. That is not good for Upper Peninsula deer. Terry Minzi of the State DNR is with us now. Terry, why is spring such a critical time for deer?
What happens in the springtime is deer in the wintertime have a reduced metabolic rate. And as we come out of March, their metabolic rates go up. The pregnant does start developing their fetus as they go into the last trimester of pregnancy. So that's a big energy drain for them. The bucks start developing their antlers, and that's a big energy drain for them. So if they can't get a green vegetation, they're on a negative energy balance. And then you add these other metabolic processes, and it really drains them down in a hurry.
So I'm just thinking of the photos, for example, the one of the of ladies standing outside, I believe it was the library in Menominee, and the monstrous, you know, piles of snow on either side. So clearly, there's not a lot of green vegetation available in the UP.
No, there really isn't. We had some time down in Menominee County, which we call the banana belt in the Upper Peninsula because they generally get less. There was some time in March where they had some open fields, but come April, it's just been snow after snow, and that's gone away.
So what's the outlook then? I guess I'm wondering, where are you on the worry scale about the deer, from no worry to very alarmed?
I would say I'm not alarmed, but I'm quite concerned. We're in a scenario now where if this snow doesn't go away soon, we're going to see impacts anyways. I suspect that we're going to see some additional fawns that are going to be dying here soon. This will probably have an impact on those does that are trying to develop their fetuses, and so we may see reduced reproduction this spring. I don't know that we're at the point where we're going to see a large-scale die-off on our adult deer yet, but if we don't get some break in this, we may get to that point.
And I guess I'm just going to put this question out there, and everybody might say, well, duh, but is there any way for humans to intervene to help, especially these pregnant females, like putting deer feed out, or is this just nature at work?
Well, this is nature at work, and certainly there are a lot of people in the Upper Peninsula who do feed deer and have been doing it all winter long, and those deer are probably going to fare a little bit better than the animals that are left on their own. But you want to be real careful about providing something with high starch in it at this time of the year if the deer aren't used to it. Corn being an example. If a deer's not used to eating corn now and you feed them corn at this point, that can kill them just as well. In fact, it'll kill them more quickly.
How much more snow do you think the deer can take?
not a lot. We have places in the Upper Peninsula right now that has well over 30 inches on the ground. This last storm that we got, I live in Ishpeming, and we got about that much just in this last storm, and we still had 18 inches on the ground. So they need a break, and they need it soon.
Terry Minzies with the Michigan DNR. Terry, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The Sweet 16 or Stanley Cup playoffs, this is not. However, Lansing is down to the finals in a different type of competition, up against the city of Hicksville, New York, for the Parking Madness 2018 Championship. Streets Blog put out a field of 16 cities where instead of parks, housing, retail, there are huge swaths of parking lots. And now it's all down to Lansing and Hicksville in the final. In the words of Streets Blog, I'm quoting here, "Take in the area around the Michigan State Capitol in downtown Lansing and try to feel something other than despair." Streets Blog argues the parking lot sucked the life out of Lansing. None produce tax revenue and they gobble up prime real estate. Voting at usa.streetsblog.org runs through tonight. Streets Blog says that the winner will be stowed with the golden crater, eternal shame, and hopefully a kick in the pants to fix its sad, sad parking crater. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.